This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for an original contemporary ballet based on a Greek legend, a journey with a possessed puppet, or a steamy Tennessee Williams play, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The Marigny Opera Ballet closes its third season with the return of Orfeo. The original full-length contemporary ballet, inspired by Monteverdi's opera, is based on the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. Choreographer Micah Taylor and producer Dave Herbert are here. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This was a sellout, standing room only performance last season. The first question that comes to my mind is, how do you improve upon that success?
Orfeo didn't really need any improvements, but we went ahead anyway. Tucker Fuller, the composer, actually edited the entire orchestral score to perfect it, in his opinion. I thought it was perfect last year, but he changed some of the instrumentation, some of the ornamentation, made small changes that are, to most people, practically indetectable. Although I thought Maya's choreography was perfect last season, she insisted on making certain small changes to the choreography, in particular in Act Two. And I've got to admit, it does look better. The level of technical and artistic achievement of our dancers has continued to increase pretty dramatically, season by season. Overall, the level of the dancing is even more brilliant than it was a year ago.
Wow. And you have new dancers this time around.
Yes, we have four new dancers joining us for Orfeo. Three of them have been with us since the beginning of the season. One of them, Edward Spots, is joining us as a guest artist for Orfeo. And then we have Lauren Gines and Joshua Bell and Christian Delery, who were three new dancers that joined us at the beginning.
And Lauren and Joshua are the new leads.
Yes, they are. Joshua plays the role of Orfeo and Lauren plays the role of Eurydice. They're two very challenging roles.
Now, this is a legend that begins at a wedding and ultimately takes us to the pits of the underworld. Tell us how the story unfolds.
So the story begins with Orfeo. He's alone. He's very melancholic. He just has his music and his lyre and his animal friends that become enchanted by his music. And he's searching for someone, for his other half. Then we're introduced to Eurydice and her friends. And in the second scene, they're introduced to each other very quickly. Then it opens on to the third scene, which is their love duet. They get married and Eurydice loses a flower crown, and then she's seduced by a serpent who kills her, unfortunately.
Orfeo is heartbroken, but he's a demigod. His father was Apollo and his mother was a mortal. So he decides to go to the underworld to bring Eurydice back to the land of the living. Unfortunately, he's not allowed in the underworld because he's not dead. It's just not done. So the king and the queen of the underworld, Pluto and Proserpina, demand that he leave. However, he discovers Eurydice there among the shades, the people in the underworld. They have a final goodbye. Proserpina, the queen of the underworld, sees them dancing, sees them together, sees how much they're in love. And she convinces Pluto, her husband, to let them go, to let him take her back to the sunlit land of the living. Pluto, though, has a trick up his sleeve. He allows them to leave, but he has one condition. On the way up to the land of the living, Orfeo cannot look back at Eurydice. If he does, all is lost, and she will return to the underworld, and Orfeo may never return. They both agree. They start their perilous way back to the land of the living. They surmount obstacles. They're approaching the sunlight. Orfeo can't hold back any longer. He looks back at his beloved. And all is lost.
What inspired you to create a ballet based on this classic story?
The myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, to me, is one of the most profound and universal stories. It has to do with the nature of love and what you do with a lost love. It has to do with what it means to act heroically and what it means to risk everything and to lose. I think that the action in this part of the myth lends itself beautifully to dancing. It really is a story that can be told without words. There aren't too many of those stories, but this one certainly.
How are you hoping this work will inspire audiences?
I really hope people leave, you know, looking at the person that they love the most and appreciating them.
And I'm hoping that they can identify in some way with the very real emotions that will be danced. True love and true loss. And I think by feeling these, we become more human. I know I do. I do at a rehearsal. I'm hoping that the audience will at one of the performances.
Maya, this production will be your swan song as you are leaving the Marigny Opera Ballet. What are your thoughts on your success in your role as choreographer and rehearsal director for the past three seasons?
I have really enjoyed my time at the Marigny Opera Ballet. It was and is my dream job to just be able to come into the space every day and get to work with an amazing group of dancers and with Dave and with all of the musicians. And, you know, I've been challenged every single day by the work that I have to do there, which I love so much. Marigny Opera Ballet allows artists to grow and to find their voice. And so when I look at my choreography from when I first started at the ballet until now, it's like a world of difference. And I really appreciate that there's a space in New Orleans for artists to do that. What this job has allowed me to do, and I say job, it's my passion and my love, is to find that voice and to help other dancers to find their voices. I really push every dancer that comes through the door and won't let them do anything but their best. And I think that comes through in the work that we do in our performances. And it's been one of my favorite parts of my whole experience there.
What does the future hold for you?
I will continue to choreograph in New Orleans, and I'm always looking to grow as a choreographer. So attending workshops and traveling and just getting as much information as I can as an artist, as a dancer still and choreographer. And then I'll be back to reset Giselle DeLand next March, I think. Yes.
Next March.
So, you know, I'll still be involved and be able to come back a year from now to work with the company again, which I'm very excited and thankful for. But yes, I'm just going to work as hard as I can to grow as a choreographer and collaborate, and That's it.
We wish you well on your journey.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Choreographer Maya Taylor and Artistic Director Dave Herbert. Thanks.
Thank you.
Performances of Orfeo run Friday through Sunday at the Marigny Opera House, 725 St. Ferdinand Street. Additional information at marignyoperahouse.org. In the interest of full disclosure, I am a board member of the Marigny Opera House Foundation. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. On the heels of its inaugural production, Reefer Madness, the musical, the Storyville Collective is back with the New Orleans premiere of Robert Askin's Hand to God. The five-time Tony-nominated play is billed as Sesame Street meets The Exorcist. It's a comedy about a possessed Christian ministry puppet. Artistic director Michael McKelvey joins us. Hello.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your second production with the Storyville Collective. How has your reception been in New Orleans?
Really, really fantastic, especially on Reefer with people just coming in and saying they like the energy of the new company and they kind of like what we're planning to produce and the style of theater that we want to make our benchmark.
Hand to God. It's a Southern expression, meaning I swear to God. But what does it mean in relation to this work?
Well, this is about a Christian puppet ministry in East Texas. It's written by Robert Askins, and he says this is partially biographical. And so in regards to the hand is of the puppeteer, a young man named Jason, and his hand actually becomes possessed. I always say that it's really his alter ego has taken over his hand and becomes the speaking point for things he's trying to get out that his will might not express. But because his hand is possessed, his alter ego is speaking through a puppet named Tyrone.
And Tyrone takes on a life of his own.
Yes, Tyrone does. We start to see it develop throughout Act One, and by the end of Act One, Tyrone has kind of declared himself as the devil.
What attracted you to this work?
I spent half my life living in Texas. I read the play. I thought it was fascinating. I did more research into the show. It's off Broadway and Broadway run. I thought the writing was just so intelligent. It's not just an over-the-top comedy. There's a lot of really heartfelt things between a single mother and her teenage son, the difficulties of that, and also a woman coming into her middle-aged years. And then we have the same thing with our pastor, Pastor Greg, and he's a middle-aged man. He's single. He's looking for a spouse or a mate, and how do men go about approaching women in their 40s or so. When I first found the play, I thought it was interesting about this puppet and the comedy, and then the more we get into it, I just think there are bigger questions here and bigger social matters. It's very intelligent.
So how does the story unfold?
So we meet Jason early on. His mother's running the Christian puppet ministry. Not successfully. She has a group of three teenagers. None of them seem that willing to really put forth the effort they need to. Jason is the little star of the group. He seems to be the most successful one of becoming a puppeteer. So she kind of needs him to be the leader, and Jason is a really shy kid and can barely speak to a girl. And then the more he becomes akin with his puppet, Tyrone, his self-confidence starts to pop up. He begins to address the female member of the group. He starts to stand up to the bully of the group, this young man named Timothy. But it's all being done through this puppet. And then towards the end of Act One, we start to learn that it's not just him having an alter ego. Potentially, his hand is possessed by the devil.
So what are the themes being explored?
Teenagers and them coming to grips with their self-confidence, false bravado of young teenage men, young women standing up for themselves and their own identity and how they deal with bullying. There's a lot of bullying that's mentioned in the play. And again, the two middle-aged characters and how they deal with being single in their 40s or so. For five characters, they're exploring a lot of things.
Now, when I hear that it's billed as something akin to Sesame Street meets The Exorcist, I'm thinking of something that's a little scary as opposed to something that's funny.
There are moments that are just downright honest and like in the audience's face, and we're confronting some heavy-duty stuff. It's much more serious than people think it is, in a good way. In a good way. And again, I think all good comedies have to have a serious side to them for them to work. Otherwise, it's just you're doing bits for 2 hours. In this case, I think the comedy comes out of these serious topics that we're bridging and done through a puppet.
What was most challenging for you in bringing this work to the stage?
Directing a puppet. Jason, played by John Fitzpatrick, who's new to New Orleans, really good young actor. He has the task of playing Jason and Tyrone at the same time because Jason and Tyrone have conversations with each other. So I direct John first as Jason, and then we'd kind of take a pause, and then I'd say, okay, let's talk about Tyrone now, and how does Tyrone really talk to Jason? When does he look at Jason? When does Jason look at Tyrone? And meanwhile, John's doing this all while he's puppeteering, because it's more than just a sock puppet. He has hands he has to deal with too. It gets a little crazy, but he's done a beautiful job with it. And then the other task was the actors having to act with a puppet talking to them and not cracking up and not thinking that this is weird, because Tyrone really is talking like the sixth actor in the show.
In addition to John Fitzpatrick, who else is in the cast?
Michael Harkins, who actually teaches at UNO and Tulane. He's great. Andrea Watson, Kyle Woods, and Meredith Owens make up the rest of the cast.
What do you think audiences will question after seeing this production?
I think the ability to really communicate from parent to child or from child to parent, dysfunctional families. Intimacy is a big one within the show. And questioning of faith. I think it'll surprise them.
Artistic Director Michael McKelvey, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks so much.
The Storyville Collective presents Robert Askin's Hand to God, with performances running through April 29th at the Theater at St. Claude, 2240 St. Claude Avenue, behind the Always Lounge. More info at brownpapertickets.com. Across town, Tennessee Williams' Tony-nominated Sweet Bird of Youth continues its run at Loyola University. The play, presented by Southern Rep Theater, is set in the 1950s, Jim Crow South, and stars an African-American male lead, Martin Bradford, and Leslie Castay, a fading movie star and gigolo clinging to impossible dreams. Leslie Castay and Martin Bradford are here. Welcome.
Hi.
Great to be here. How's it going?
Another steamy work by Tennessee Williams set along the Gulf Coast is garnering attention, and this is adopted home, New Orleans. Tell me what attracted you to the work.
I was just interested in taking on a new challenge. Certain playwrights like August Wilson, Shakespeare, Tennessee Williams, they have these juicy stories and these monologues and this poetry and these unique situations, and just getting an opportunity to take that on, take that life into my body and accept the challenge and tell the story and produce the message. It was attractive to me.
Yes, the opportunity to do one of the lesser produced plays of Williams was a great treat and a challenge. The one Tennessee Williams play out of all of them that I'd been most anxious and excited about working on. It's just got so much there to work with and a lot of good juicy stuff for an actress. It was done on Broadway starring Geraldine Page and Paul Newman. I think it's one of the only Williams plays from Broadway that made the transfer to the big screen with the same stars attached.
So what was Tennessee's inspiration for this work?
I think a lot of it was autobiographical in a strange way. Tennessee had great friendships with many movie stars. He was very close with Tallulah Bankhead, and he did write this piece with her in mind. She did not end up starring in it originally. She did a later version of it. I think she did a production in Florida at some time in the 60s.
And so much of this deals with facing your mortality, youth, getting old, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like he left pieces of himself throughout this work.
So let's set the stage. This is a work that Tennessee wrote in the 1950s. What's he exploring? What's it about?
So Alexandra DeLago is a fading movie star who escapes and flees Hollywood after what she sees as a failed comeback. She goes to the premiere and sees her close-up on the screen and is terrified and traumatized by it and flees and, in her exile, picks up a young beach boy named Chance Wayne.
Who is a gigolo and a drifter.
Is gigolo, drifter, former actor, wannabe actor that's only appeared like in background roles and extra where he never got that big break. They come across each other and he has his plan to get her to fund him. He's trying to, like, once again, win back the town, the respect of the town. He's trying to get his girl back, Heavenly, that's his hometown sweetheart, that he would come back and forth to the town to visit, but he wants her love. He wants to take her out of St. Cloud with him to this Hollywood success that he's getting off of being connected to Alexandra DeLago. And he thinks that things will just turn out okay. He thinks he can come back with this contract, supposedly, and win his girl back and everything's going to be good, but it doesn't all turn out that way.
What's his big dilemma?
He's done something wrong. He's done something wrong, and the entire town knows it, and he doesn't even realize the thing that he did wrong. It has greatly affected Heavenly, which is his girl that he's trying to win back. So while he believes that he's coming in the big hero, everyone's going to love him, is going to be a piece of cake, he's coming back to a time where he's the bad guy. And he has to find out why he's the bad guy and how he's going to maneuver into getting that success that keeps eluding him.
This takes place in your hometown, maybe say, is a fictional town of St. Cloud, probably on the Mississippi Gulf Coast.
Right.
And it's your girlfriend's father is the big political boss of the area who doesn't take kindly for Chance coming back to town.
Right.
And that's out to exact some pound of flesh,
revenge,
so you should say.
Of sorts.
What was going on in Tennessee Williams' life when he wrote this?
I think his partner, Frank Merlo, he was either very sick, dying of cancer, or had just died. I'm not sure which. He was definitely past middle age at this point himself and had a history of picking up young men as distraction from panic, much like the character of Alexander Delago. He was highly medicated. So the character of Alexander Delago is highly medicated, highly addicted to pills and booze. I mean, even through Williams, I think, pharmaceutical haze, he had the clarity to know the reasons underneath it and why. Alexandra has a wonderful monologue about getting old and why she's doing this. As she's smoking hash and drinking vodka and taking pills, she says, "This, you either get so old, what you loved has died, so you either die or you find something else." And she holds up her joint of hash and says, "This is my something else." It's so sad, but at the same time, he has such a clear-eyed vision of the truth underneath it and why people reach out to these things as a panacea, as a sedative, to dull, you know, the ache of the real pain, that people have, you know, that they don't lack the courage to go on. I love the play because ultimately I think my character sort of finds her way of dealing with going on, of finding the courage and choosing life at any cost.
What else is being explored?
I think hate and acceptance and conformity are other themes there that he deals with through the characters of Boss and the small-mindedness of the townspeople then at that time. Hypocrisy.
Race becomes a factor even before you add in the black actors. Some of the verbiage, some of the lines, once you throw black actors in, they start becoming more prominent. It's a different thing when you hear him say that Chance Wayne is the mental equivalent of any white man in the South when everyone's white. But then when it's a black guy, it's almost like, okay, what does that line mean? In the midst of all this, I don't think he meant to have race be a part, but in the context of like 2017 or like I said, or even throwing black actors in here, it's almost like you can't ignore it.
What life lessons might audiences take away from this production?
I hope people take away a sense of empathy and maybe understanding and a little more tolerance toward people who maybe choose a different path.
These characters seem to regret so much. My character's trying to get something that missed him, and a lot of her character is so caught up in what she had, so it's like, screw the head, let's get it now. When people come to see it, I hope they leave with, chase your dreams, get it before it leaves you.
Actors Leslie Castay and Martin Bradford.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Southern Rep Theater presents Tennessee Williams, Sweet Bird of Youth. Performances run through Sunday in Loyola University's Marquette Theater, 6363 St. Charles Avenue. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.